supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
From the Voices in the Family, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Depression can break your heart. Literally, research over the last two decades has shown that depression and heart disease are common companions and that each can lead to the other. A study conducted in Baltimore found that 1,500 people who were free of heart disease, those who had a history of depression, were four times more likely to suffer a heart attack over the next 14 years. In addition, researchers in Montreal, Canada, found that heart patients who were depressed were four times as likely to die in the next 6 months as those who weren't depressed. On today's show, we'll discuss this connection between depression and other mood states and our hearts and find out what we should know, what we should discuss with our doctors, and what can be done. My guests are Dr. Lawson Wilson and Dr. Michael Bain. Wilson has written Treating the Aching Heart. He's a professor of psychiatry and family medicine at the University of Cincinnati. He also writes a weekly column called Mind Matters for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Lawson, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here, Dan.
Michael Bain is director of the Penn Program for Stress Management. He's also a clinical assistant professor of medicine at Penn School of Medicine. Michael, welcome back.
Thank you.
Our phone number here is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We're talking about the connection between depression and other mood states and our hearts. Michael, let me start with you. Whenever we hear about the risk factors for heart disease, we hear about diet, exercise, blood pressure, weight, and genetics. So what's not on that list that we should know about?
What's not on the list are the things that are possibly the most important, psychological and social variables. Things like the presence or absence of depression, hostility and aggression, social support, and even economic standing carry at least as much importance in the association between heart disease and other factors as does blood pressure, cholesterol, and smoking.
As much.
As much, yes.
Well, Lawson, the data that we know about what puts people at risk for heart disease, you say it comes mostly from white men. So what are the implications of that? And what would you want to add to the list?
Well, I think what we know about heart disease that was developed in the 60s and 70s and the 80s, sort of the heyday of epidemiology of heart disease, was initially done mostly on white men. I think in the last 15 years or so, a number of longitudinal studies have started and have expanded their interest. The Jackson study is interested in African Americans, and there are many more women involved in these studies now. So that's changing and likely to get a whole lot better and more balanced. I think that the major problem that Dr. Bain is pointing out is that the American Heart Association, which is the major educator of the public, defines stress in such a vague fashion on their website and in their publications that nobody can make practical use of their nod towards stress as a contributing factor to heart disease. There's no mention of how best to measure it, what constitutes bad stress as opposed to good stress, and that's part of what motivated me to write this book and why I'm glad we're doing this program.
Well, and one of the many reasons why I'm glad Michael Bain's here, because he's the stress maven. So what is good stress and bad stress, and how does it get measured?
There's good news and bad news, because you can't measure it with an MRI or a blood test. Good stress is stress that motivates you, that helps you, that energizes you, that directs you. And bad stress is what beats you down, overwhelms you, wakes you up in the middle of the night, and makes you sick.
Subjective.
It is subjective, because the thing that might leave you pounding your fists on the table might come to me as a challenge. So it's very personal. It depends on your history and what you think about it and how it feels to you.
And physiologically, how is good stress good for you?
Well, the thing that becomes overwhelming to the body when it is too intense and sustained actually directs the body when it isn't overwhelming. So when you're confronted with a sudden stress, your body responds in a way that directs you towards action. That action might be helpful. But if you can't take helpful action, and if you can't manage the stress or do something about it, and you continue to have the same thing happen over and over again, it is no longer helpful.
Hmm. There was a book, Ed Halliwell, the ADD guy, wrote a book on worry. And he said, if you find yourself up in the middle of the night worrying about starvation in Asia or South Africa, you might as well go back to sleep. But if you wake up in the middle of the night and you're worried that you haven't paid your health insurance premium that month, he said, that's a good worry. You know, then get up and pay your health insurance premium. So some of it's constructive, and you need it. You need to be able to worry about some things in your life.
Sure.
You know, I think we have in the last 10 years or so also come a long way in being able to define physiologically the difference between good stress and bad stress.
How so?
Well, if you think of the stress response system as a hormonal and neural pathway from the brain to the rest of the body, it's possible to monitor that system and show whether it is responding to a challenge and then recovering from a challenge. And most of the bad stress that's really relevant to heart disease is measurable through the dysregulation of this stress response system well beyond the period of the challenge. In other words, we stay alert far beyond the threat, and our system can't calm down and switch back to first gear. That's bad stress if it persists over months and years.
Right, and that's why, if we're living in that state of stress, which I venture to say most of us are, that a pothole in the road feels like a mountain lion to many of us. That's why we are overreacting and so reactive to difficulties in our environment. Tell me about, I guess I'll turn to you, Lawson. What's happening to our bodies physiologically when we're depressed?
Well, I think that depends on the severity and the duration of the depression. And I think it's important, since we're talking about the link to heart disease, to distinguish between mild, transient symptoms of depression or even a few weeks of depressed mood on the one hand, and on the other hand, chronic or recurrent major depression that really impairs functioning, physiological functioning, psychological and social functioning. In the case of recurrent or chronic depression, the physiologic changes that really add to the risks for heart disease and exacerbate existing heart disease have to do with the tendency towards weight gain, the rise in resting heart rate, the overreaction, the increased adrenaline response to physical challenges and mental challenges, changes in the regulation of heart rate, changes in inflammatory markers that suggest that the inflammation process has gone out of control.
So I'm not clear, and I guess I should turn to you, Michael, too, whether you're talking about depression causing these problems or the byproducts of depression, so that when you're depressed, you're less likely to keep an eye on what you eat, and you're less likely to exercise or socialize, which has a variety of physiologic consequences. Michael?
Well, it is a feedback loop. so that it's hard to say exactly where it starts. You have a heart attack and you become depressed and your behavior changes and your risk increases, and because our lives have so many variables, and because life isn't a laboratory, it becomes difficult to tease out what the inciting event is. And I think that it's probably fair to say that it goes both ways, that there's a very strong association with stress and depression and both the incidence and outcome of heart disease, and that heart disease also causes stress and depression. So it's difficult to tease out each part. They're all important, and it does work both ways.
I want to challenge something you said, or at least to follow up something you said, Michael, that heart disease causes depression. Certainly it doesn't in everyone. So I'd like, do we know, and I'll turn to you, Lawson, do we know who is at more risk for depression following heart disease and who is not?
That's a really good question. I think one of the reasons that depression after a heart attack or a cardiac event gets overlooked is the common assumption made by both patients, families, and even their doctors that, of course, you'll be a little bit depressed after you have a heart attack. The truth is, only about 40% of people after a heart attack or a bypass operation have clinical depression, and half of them have major depression, the other half have minor depression. So most people do not have a depressive disorder after depression, after a cardiac event.
What's the difference?
What is the difference between what?
I should have finished the sentence. Between those two groups, between the 40% and the 60%.
Yes, good question. The people who have had previous episodes of depression are at increased likelihood of being depressed after a cardiac event, but the depression that is triggered for the first time in life, usually in the 50s or 60s, by a cardiac event, happens equally to men as women. And it doesn't follow family history patterns the way most younger depressions do. And so it's a different disorder with a different set of epidemiology or risk factors. And that makes it a little hard to predict who's going to develop a depression afterwards, but people who've had previous depression or previous mental illness are at greater risk, and people who've got other risk factors for depression are at greater risk.
Such as other risk factors for depression?
Oh, people who have poverty or other forms of chronic stress. People who've got women, for example, are at, women aren't at greater risk for developing their first depression after heart disease. It's equal for men and women. Substance abusers. Those are the major risk factors that contribute. But the truth is, we really don't know as much about this vascular depression, as it's currently being called, as we do about the kind of depression that usually hits people younger, and it's women more often than men.
And we know, of course, the other risk factors for depression with anyone are family history of depression, and social isolation increases the risks.
Right.
We're going to take a break now and go to some of our callers. We're talking about the connection between depression, stress, the so-called negative mood states, and cardiovascular disease, that cycle between the two. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. My guests are Dr. Lawson Wilson. He's written Treating the Aching Heart. He's a professor of psychiatry and family medicine at the University of Cincinnati. Here in the studio is Dr. Michael Boehm, director of the Penn Program for Stress Management. He's a clinical assistant professor of medicine at Penn School of Medicine. Like I said, our phone number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices from the Family. It's right here on WHYY. 91 FM.
Supporting WHYY Mainline School Night with over 500 day, evening, and Saturday courses from City Line to Paoli. Details at 610-687-0460 or online at mainlineschoolnight.org.
The Penn Program for Stress Management supports WHYY and features a mindfulness and intimacy program for couples. Dr. Dan Gottlieb of WHYY's Voices in the Family and Dr. Michael Baim, director of the Penn Program for Stress Management, encourage you to experience how mindfulness can enhance intimacy, caring, and connectedness. Details at 215-615-2774 or stress.management@uphs.upenn.edu.
Supporting WHYY, 10,000 Villages in the Satterton Shopping Center, hosting an Oriental Rug Event September 12th through the 15th, offering fairly traded hand-knotted rugs. Details at 215-723-1221.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about heart disease and depression and the other so-called negative emotions, how they contribute to heart disease or they contribute to prognosis or vice versa. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. My guests are Dr. Michael Baim, who's director of the Penn Program for Stress Management, and Dr. Lawson Wilson, who's written Treating the Aching Heart. He's a professor of psychiatry and family medicine at the University of Cincinnati. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Roger on line two. Roger?
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I was interested in asking, I guess, the stress-related professional there, the first guest you mentioned, what the likelihood of people that suffer panic attacks and also veterans returning with delayed stress is that they're more susceptible to heart problems.
Michael?
Well, they are definitely more susceptible, although the association with heart disease isn't as strong for panic attacks as it is for some of the other illnesses like major depressive episode or even generalized anxiety. This is really an area where Dr. Wilson is the expert, so I would defer to his judgment on that. Dr. Wilson?
Well, I think it's a really good question for which we don't have a really satisfactory answer. People with panic disorder, which is a series of panic attacks, are at greater risk for cardiac-related illnesses like hypertension, but we don't have good longitudinal studies to really show us how big the increased risk is from panic attacks. Independent of the related effect of depression, because lots of people with panic attacks also have depression. But certainly having any kind of severe anxiety disorder adds to the general burden on the central nervous system and on the cardiovascular system.
Roger, let me comment, too, as a non-medical person. Whether you've got PTSD, panic attacks, or generalized anxiety disorder, you're suffering. And that's not good. And all of these things are quite treatable. So whether they're connected directly to heart problems or not, or connected indirectly, almost doesn't matter. What we want to do is diminish suffering. And all are treatable. And the sooner they get treated, like everything else, the better the prognosis. Thanks for your call, Roger. We're talking about the connection between emotions, mood states, depression, and heart disease. Our number is 888-477-9499. Michael, there's something you mentioned earlier, and I'd like that developed a little bit because I'm concerned about it too, and that's the relationship between social isolation and cardiovascular disease.
Yes, there's also a very strong association between lots of social and interpersonal situations and the risk for heart disease. It is true not just in people, but it's true in animals. So it's deeply biological, and it's clearly built into the system. If you take a monkey out of its social group every 3 months and put it into a new social group where it has to fight for its place in the dominance hierarchy, in sort of the order of power among that group, that monkey gets accelerated heart disease. And in people, too, just having somebody that you can depend on, having somebody who you know will be there for you, having a supportive family or a supportive marriage has a real effect on your risk of having an initial event and on your likelihood of surviving that event and doing well after it's occurred.
That's a correlational observation. Does that fit with your research also, Lawson?
Yes, and I think the person who first spelled out that interesting observation was a physiologist in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins, who wrote a book about the effect of social isolation on people in coronary care units and monitored the effect of physical touch and conversation on heart rate and arrhythmias, and made a very persuasive argument that social isolation, even on a minute-to-minute basis, contributes to heart disease. And these studies were driven by epidemiologic observations that events of isolation, such as separation or death or bereavement, contribute to exacerbations of existing heart disease.
So I want to nuance the language a bit. When we talk about social isolation, there was a study that came out about 2 years ago that showed that the number of people we call confidants, intimate friends, has decreased, or average number has decreased from 3 to 2 over the last decade, so that the average person now has 2, and 40% of the people in the report reported that they have only one confidant, and the percentage of people who have none has also increased. So we are becoming increasingly isolated, and I wonder if we can look at some of this quantitatively. Like, what happens when we only have one close friend or two close friends? Does that increase our risk, I wonder?
I certainly think it does. And one of the most powerful pieces of epidemiologic evidence about depression in the last 50 years is a series of curves showing that the age of onset for depression has increased steadily since the early 1930s. And this epidemic of depression in the U.S. is not very well explained, but one of the proposed explanations is exactly what you're saying, Dan, which is that the nuclear family and the extended family has dwindled to the point where we have fewer confidants, we have fewer close people, and we feel increasingly more isolated, and that sets us up at for more risk for depression, and then the complications of depression, which we're now saying include heart disease later on.
Yeah, the ramifications of this problem of isolation goes on and on, and I think our technology in some ways helps foster the isolation. Gee, I read a study years ago from HUD, Department of Housing and Urban Development, years ago, and they said that 3 out of 5 people move every 5 years on the average. So you don't really need to know any more than that, you know, to understand the issue of isolation. We can't grow roots. You know, it's difficult.
I want to come back, Dan, to one of your earlier questions about behavioral versus physiological pathways, and Mike's comment that it's both. I really think it's important to understand that kind of isolation that you're talking about really fosters some behaviors that contribute to depression and heart disease, but it also has some immediate physiological effects, such as raising heart rate and blood pressure and inflammation and making people eat more in nervous sorts of ways and sleep less well. So there's both the behavior pathway and the physiologic pathway that contribute to this relationship between depression and heart disease.
And that's what we're talking about today, the relationship between depression and heart disease, the physiology of our mood states. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Lawson, when you and I spoke on the telephone previously, we talked about the phrase brokenhearted. And when we think about it, brokenhearted usually represents an acute loss or grief. This is something all humans experience. I don't think you're putting the message out there that acute grief puts you at risk for cardiovascular disease, or are you?
No. And I think what is most impressive is how much acute grief we all go through without having our hearts break. Our hearts are extremely resilient. And so there's we ought to be careful about overstating the situation. It's the rare dramatic event that leads to sudden death in somebody who doesn't already have heart disease. What's more impressive is how resilient our hearts are. I think the message here is that it's chronic, recurrent, or episodic stress that really jacks up the risk for heart disease, just the way smoking a little bit now and then isn't going to give you raise your risk. But if you smoke regularly over an extended period of time, it raises your risk for heart disease. And the same is true of chronic exposure to stress, and particularly major depression.
Well, and we know that pain helps make us resilient in the long run, that we shouldn't avoid all suffering at all costs, like so many of us do in this culture. Michael, you teach stress management through mindfulness meditation, but even with practice, the goal is not to eliminate all suffering.
You can't eliminate the suffering. It comes with getting up in the morning sometimes. It's just part of life. But sometimes we add an extra constriction on top of that, that the difficulties that we face create a kind of a tightness in our being that we carry around with us. And when we say that we're stressed, we usually mean that we're carrying around that kind of a tightness in our hearts.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Diane on the line. Hi, Diane. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. I am 62 years old, and I have been on antidepressants and also on anti-anxiety medication.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as I've been on this medication, I have felt fine. And I think I'm like a lifer. I mean, this anxiety and depression seems to run in my family. As long as I'm taking this medication, am I still at a higher risk?
That's a great question. Lawson, you want to tackle that?
Yes. The scientific answer, the scientifically honest answer is we haven't proven that you are reducing your risk, but good clinicians and good clinical wisdom suggest that you're going a long way towards reducing the risk, because if you're feeling better and functioning better, your stress response system is working well, and you're not overwhelmed. I think it's the chronic overwhelmed stress response system that really contributes to the increased heart rate, but we still have some very expensive and long studies to do to verify this in a scientifically rigorous fashion.
Michael?
Yes, I guess I have two answers, and I agree with the one that we just heard, that the study that the best study looked at individuals after they'd had a heart attack and treated those who were depressed with an antidepressant, and they became less depressed, but it didn't change their risk for subsequent problems with their heart. And then the second answer is, who cares?
Right.
Because if you feel like living again, if you feel more confident and less anxious, I think that what matters is not that you're going to live to be 95, but that whatever hours and months and years that you have are more successful, more connected to the people around you in your life, and happier.
Okay. Well, I do make a big effort to see my family that lives about 200 miles away, and to keep that connection, you know, and those bonds, as well as my friends. But the family connection, I think, has been very important to me.
Well, what Michael said what all three of us have been saying on the show, is that all connections are life-sustaining at all levels. So, yeah, please keep up the connections. And, yeah, if you're a lifer, you know, we're all a lifer at something. So so there you go. I wish you the best, Diane.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. Just on a side, Lawson, she called herself a lifer. We know that the rule of thumb is that if you have three episodes of major depression, you're probably going to need to stay on medication for the rest of your life because the risk is so high of having another episode.
That's true, and I think it's particularly true for people who have risks for heart disease. In other words, the consequences of having a fourth episode are even greater if you're also dealing with cardiac risk factors and or existing heart disease. So that's a really good point. And I think she also makes an interesting point, which is that there is also one good study from the Heart and Soul study, which is really focused on depression's effects on heart disease, that the best predictor of poor quality of life among people with coronary disease is not how many heart attacks you've had or how bad your ejection fraction is, but the severity of your depression.
Hmm. That's the best predictor.
Yeah.
You've got depression and heart disease in your family, and you said in the book that you've experienced dysthymia, the milder form of depression. Does dysthymia increase your risk?
It does, and I think that's one of the most interesting debates going on in this little area of psychosomatic medicine, is where is the critical threshold? You know, it's clear that the worse your depression is and the longer you've had it, the greater your risk. So worse depression is worse for your heart disease, but mild depression also has an impact on risk for heart disease. Even that study by Ford that you mentioned with the 14-year follow-up, even people with mild to moderate symptoms had a significant increased risk. So dysthymia of the sort that I've experienced and lots of people experience is worth getting treated, not necessarily with medications, but you know, exercise can be good, psychotherapy can be good, but people ought to pay attention to the milder end of the spectrum as well as the more severe disabling depression.
What is it? What are some of the symptoms? How does one know if...
About dysthymia?
Yeah.
Okay. Dysthymia technically is simply 2 to 4 symptoms for many months, usually 2 years, without a period of a couple of months free of depression symptoms. So I, for instance, experience fatigue, insomnia, and sluggishness in my thinking. That's 3. I didn't have 5 or 6 and didn't ever end up taking medication, but it was enough to really slow me down for a couple of years.
We should also say, someone was on the show, last year, we were talking about depression. He said something very interesting. He said, depression begins and ends from the outside in. He said, others will notice that you're depressed before you'll feel it. And others will notice you're getting better before you'll feel it. And I just thought that was a fascinating observation and probably accurate.
Well, I think that is true for a number of people. It can also work the opposite way. But it's particularly important, I think, for people who are depressed to have people close to them who understand depression help them observe either early relapses or early improvements.
We're going to have to take a short break. We're talking about the connection between depression, stress, and cardiovascular disease. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. My guests are Dr. Michael Boehm. He's the director of the Penn Program for Stress Management. He's a clinical assistant professor of medicine at Penn. And Dr. Lawson Wilson, who's written Treating the Aching Heart. He joins us by phone. He's a professor of psychiatry and family medicine at the University of Cincinnati. Again, our number is 888-477-9499. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
This will require increasing American force levels.
In February, President Bush boosted troop levels in Iraq.
To help Iraqis clear and secure neighborhoods, to help them protect the local population, and to help ensure that the Iraqi forces left behind are capable of providing the security that Baghdad needs.
Is the surge working? Details of General David Petraeus' official progress report next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the relationship between depression, stress, negative mood states, and heart disease. My guests are Lawson Wilson, who's written Treating the Aching Heart. He's a professor of psychiatry and family medicine at the University of Cincinnati. Dr. Michael Boehm also joins us. He's head of the Penn Program for Stress Management, and he's a clinical assistant professor of medicine at Penn there also. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Sabrina on line one. Sabrina, hi, you're on Voices.
Hi. My question is in my family it's more congestive heart failure than heart disease. I understand they're two different things. But my dad's surely depressed, but he's concerned because he's got a lot of hardware in there, you know, pacemakers and defibrillators, and he takes a lot of drugs. And I think his excuse for not treating his depression is that he doesn't want yet one more drug to take in the battery that he takes every day. And so I'm not really sure how to get him past that, how to help him seek treatment when the treatment sounds like another drug that he doesn't know how it's going to counteract with everything else he's taking.
Well, part of it makes sense. Part of it is he doesn't know what this drug is going to do and how it's going to interact with all the other stuff. Part of it sounds like depressed thinking. When he says, I don't want to take one more drug, well, that's depressed thinking. That's someone who's accommodated his depression where it feels okay to be depressed. Let's turn to our experts here. Michael, what do you know about the interactive effects with?
Not much. I mean, he is unlikely to have to worry about the cardiac side effects from most recently developed, currently used antidepressants, although some of the less commonly used older antidepressants could have significant cardiac effects. But the whole thrust of this topic is the understanding that what happens in your mind doesn't just affect how you feel, it affects whether you live or die. And if anything, he has a much stronger mandate to be treated for medical reasons as well as psychological reasons. And so I agree with Dan. He's not really thinking about it that way, maybe because he feels hopeless and depressed.
Lawson, this I want to turn to you now, as both a physician and a psychiatrist. So, how do you turn to a man who's got all sorts of cardiac problems that may be life threatening, and he's feeling depressed? And how do you break the news to him that he's also got a disease called depression that needs treatment?
Well, I think you have to begin with what he understands about depression and try to expand it into arenas that provide him more hope. For example, I think it'd be important to find out what he understands about non-pharmacologic treatments of depression, which are as effective as depression and can certainly amplify the effect of antidepressants. And if he's feeling uncomfortable about pharmacologic treatments for depression, you could begin with psychotherapy, exercise, light therapy, omega-3, supplements. On the other hand, I think the
argument that you also want to make to him is that effective treatment for depression can actually reduce the number of drugs that he gets, reduce the number of visits he has to make by decreasing, helping him to decrease his blood pressure, sleep better, manage his arrhythmias better if that's a part of his congestive heart failure.
Michael, part of what you do, Sabrina, thanks so much for your call.
Oh, yeah, thank you very much, guys.
Michael, part of what you do in stress management, well, let's talk about what you do in stress management and what kind of impact that has.
Well, the primary focus of our program is a series of meditation-based tools collectively known as mindfulness. And these techniques train you to bring your attention out of the past, where you're ruminating over your failures and mistakes, and out of the future, where you have anxiety and fears for what will happen, and bring that attention into the present moment, where you can find relaxation, rest, and a kind of a balance. And as people learn to do that over time, they do find consistently that their mood improves. There's a whole field of what is called the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy of depression, which is sort of an amalgam between mindfulness meditation, as we teach it, and formal cognitive behavioral therapy. In our program, we've tracked mood states in more than 3,000 people over the last 15 years. And these aren't people who have clinical depression. These are people who are stressed and do have some depressed mood at times. And on a standard mood scale, their depression decreases by about 40% over an 8-week course.
I wonder if we know anything about the physiology.
Well, we know for sure that it affects brain function, that one of the areas where we do research at Penn is in functional brain imaging during meditation and after meditation. And we see significant changes, including changes in some of the areas that are affected by depression.
What do you recommend, Lawson, when someone comes to you and is clearly living under a great deal of stress?
Well, one of the first things I try to find out is whether or not they've ever had any training in relaxation techniques, because that not only improves their autonomic physiology, but it also gives them a sense of control and power in the context of an illness that usually robs people of their sense of control and power.
And certainly that losing a sense of control correlates very highly with depression.
Sure. And I think that that is something that lots of psychiatrists often overlook, this relaxation training skill and methodology, partly because psychiatrists get frustrated at not succeeding very well at teaching it to people. But that's certainly a hurdle that's easy to overcome. Cognitive therapy, as Mike said, is, I think, the other really well-tested form of psychotherapy that's effective for depression and can be tailored to really managing the risks for heart disease. I think another example of what's good for the heart is good for the brain is omega-3 fatty acid supplements or fish oil supplements. Very good for lowering triglycerides, reducing inflammation, and good for managing depression with very few side effects.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Terry on the line. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Hi, Dan. Dr. Dan, my husband had a heart attack in his 30s with no family history or any real major risk factors, and he very much attributes to stress, home and other. He's taken many steps in exercise, attempting to reduce stress, setting boundaries, working with a psychologist and other things. Oh, vacations are important, too, to us, but I wanted to see what other things can I do to help him, you know, to be, you know, live well and do well into the future. And this is about 8 to 10 years ago that this happened.
Michael?
Boy, I think you've done the best thing that you could possibly do, which is to ask the question and to care. I think that anything else is secondary to that. You can't fix his life, and you can't make his stress go away, but you can support him, you can be there, you can be present for him, and you can be the person who he can depend on, which we know is an important factor and associated with heart disease outcome.
Terry, I would add something else, that if your support for him includes hypervigilance, includes doing all the research you can to look for ways of helping him, I'd be concerned about the stress on you.
Oh, and I don't take that on, but I'm there. I don't think I'm doing that, so.
Okay, because we need you to take care of you, too. Lawson, do you want to add anything on to...
Yeah, I think the other piece that you might try to work out with your husband is some consistent way of measuring how effective your stress management efforts are, because it's very possible that you've already achieved an optimal level of stress management. And it's important to be able to honestly assess what works and what doesn't work.
How would you do that?
Well, there are self-report measures that you can use consistently over time to chart levels of stress. He could do it. You could do it. There are also biofeedback measures, such as measuring resting heart rate, which is a good measure of autonomic arousal and the balance between the fight-or-flight response and the more relaxing sides of the autonomic nervous system.
I would also add something. I'll take a page out of Michael's playbook here. I'm sure he won't get too upset. I mean, the other thing you could do, both of you, is just sit quietly for about 5 minutes and breathe and just check in on your bodies and see if you feel open or closed or tense, and just check in on yourself a couple times a day. I think that kind of feedback is generally pretty accurate. Michael?
Well, and really you're talking about doing what is, in effect, a formal meditation practice. It's just in a more unstructured way, that stopping to just feel yourself, to find where you actually are, to see if you're speeding ahead of yourself or if you've become lost to yourself. And especially if you can do that with your partner, the way that that creates closeness, the way that it makes intimacy and connectedness more possible, can strengthen your relationship in a way that strengthens his physical heart as well as his emotional one.
Lawson, thanks so much for your call, Terry. I hope that was helpful.
That was. Thank you.
Lawson, when we talk about change in the system, you addressed in your book politics and the need to stop the artificial division between the National Institute of Health and the National Institute of Mental Health. Could you just address the broad picture of what we need to look at here?
Yes. Part of what drove me to write this book is that I think the problem of depression and heart disease on a public health level is symbolic, or it's representative of the problem that we're facing in our country for chronic illness management in general. Namely, we're working in a system that is basically designed to treat acute illnesses and is not very good for treating chronic illnesses. So one of the things that I think we really need to do is integrate mental health services into primary care practices. That means hiring mental health specialists to see patients at the site of primary care treatment. We need to establish better guidelines for screening for depression in patients who are at risk for coronary disease, both in primary care settings but also in cardiac care centers where they're likely to be thoroughly evaluated. We certainly, on the other side of the question, need to do much better at evaluating cardiac risk factors in patients who come to mental health centers, who are at great risk for early death, mostly because of cardiac problems. We need a big public health education program so that people understand just how this, how psychological and social factors really drive the number one killer in this country and around the world. And finally, we really need to find some political way of getting the arms of the National Institutes of Health and hopefully the pharmaceutical industry to really focus on how the how depression and heart disease is an example of how the central nervous system and the cardiovascular system are so seamlessly intertwined but have been so studied in such silos all the way along.
Yeah, and it's not just heart disease and depression. It's, you know, we've got our National Institute of Alcoholism. We've got our National Institute of Drug Abuse. We've got, and on and on. Michael, what needs to change about the way we practice medicine in this area? I know there's lots of...
It's really the same answer, which is that we have to stop viewing human beings as disconnected organ systems that require a specific fix, that the whole way that we view our healthcare system is as if we're taking our body to the plumber and he'll find where the blockage in the pipe is and, you know, he'll replace it with a new section of pipe or ream it out with a balloon or whatever. You know, and our fantasy is that if we could just get the right pill, everything would be better. But that's not how people are, and that's not how life works.
One of my requests as a patient, and a frequent patient, is I would like ideally for my doctor to sit down with me and say, tell me about your life, rather than tell me about your symptoms. But I wonder if my request is reasonable, and given the fact that, you know, you guys have to see so many patients per hour. Is it reasonable to ask you to ask me to tell you about my life and how it's going?
It's a shame, but it is not. It is not, because the time pressure on the doctors, who are very concerned about the biology of your body, about the prescription that they have to write, does not allow them the time and the space to do that. Although the best physicians, the ones who really... bring a sense of healing into the room with them, don't need a lot of time to do that. And when you come across someone who's gifted in that way, you know it right away and you don't leave.
Right.
And maybe we could train people to do a better job of that.
Right, to care differently, to care in a way that they are safe and their patients are more safe. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank both of you for joining us today. My guests have been Lawson Wilson and Michael Bain. Wilson's a professor of psychiatry and family medicine at the University of Cincinnati. He's the author of Treating the Aching Heart, A Guide to Depression, Stress, and Heart Disease. Bain's a clinical assistant professor of medicine at Penn. He also runs the Penn Program for Stress Management. Consistent with that, he and I are going to be teaching a course together starting the end of September on mindfulness approach to intimacy in couples relationships. You can find more information about that in my upcoming lectures on my webpage, which is drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show's been Al Banks. Shane Ewing is our intern. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. Me? I'm Dan Gottlieb, the host. Have a good week, my friends.